Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here live with Atlanta Business Radio, and I am excited to have one of my favorite speakers in the whole United States of America. Mr. Jack Perry Jr. with Source Point Coaching. He's got a new book, and I also got a veteran of the Business Radio X studio, Lloyd Lofton, with American Eagle Financial Services, and he's got a new training thingamadoogie he's up to. But first up, Jack Perry. Welcome, Jack.
How you been? Welcome. It's good to be back here again, back in the studio, and seeing you again, and meeting your wonderful dad.
That's right. Well. That's a treat for you. I brought him because of your book. Why don't you share what that book's about, what it's titled?
The name of the book is called The Other Side of Anger, A Sudden Search for Peace. I wrote the book about, it was published and put on the market August 15th of this year. It's doing very well on Amazon.com and also in the Kindle version. The impetus for the book, Ali, as you know, was the relationship that I had with my father growing up and what I saw, his behavior, the things he went through, what I went through, and those behaviors were, you know, domestic violence, alcohol, anger, fear. And towards the end of his life, I had the opportunity to sit down with my dad at his bedside in a hospice before he passed away and asked him some very deep, biting questions that I believe every young man and woman should be able to talk to their parents about. And I just wanted to know. I wanted to know about why he was the way he was. I recognized his anger at a very early age, about 14 or 15 years old. I didn't know how to put my finger on it at that time. I just knew something wasn't quite right. So I bottled it up, held it up for many, many years, for 20, 30 years. And then one day I had the opportunity. I said, you know what? My dad is dying. I know he's going to leave this earth soon. And I want to know. I want to know what's going on so I don't make the same mistakes in my life, and what did I learn from this? Interesting, he acknowledged, he goes, I am an angry man. He knew how to go, crap, you know. I really affected some people's lives over my lifetime. And so other things transpired during that conversation with my dad, which is in the book. And it was interesting because when I left the hospital room, that was the last time I saw my dad alive, I put my hand on his chest and I prayed with him and I told him I loved him and I forgave him for all of that over the years. And I said, you know what, this has got to get out somewhere. So I wrote the book about it, and it was tough, but it had to be done. And so go ahead.
Now, was he remorseful?
You know what? He never verbally came out and said he was. I think that old school pride, ego crap that gets in the way stopped him from doing that. So I will say to you, in all honesty, that he left this earth without ever saying, I'm sorry. But I felt just from the bonding moment with my dad, meeting and my dad, knowing him over the years, in his eyes, I could tell he got it. He just didn't know how to, like most of us men, we don't know how to verbalize it and go, crap, sorry.
You think it was a generational issue?
You know, that's a great question. Is it a generational issue? I really don't think so, because I see it also in young men today. As Lee pointed out, I own a company, you know, Source Point Coaching, and I work with young men and women. In fact, I just got a call sitting in the green room here with a new client, a young man that is searching for who he is. So I don't think it's generational. I think that we men are just stubborn at times. We let our ego, our pride stuff get in the way from what's really, truly important in our life. And I think with my father, it just snowballed so much that he did not know how to ask for help or to, that was it.
You think he didn't know how to be any other way?
He did know how to be another way, and I saw it at times when when something emotional would trigger him. If he saw anything that involved my mother or something that involved one of us kids, that was an outside stimulus, not that he had created or caused, but it was something on the outside, somebody messing with the family, that it would, you could see it come out. But when it was internal in the house, if he created it, nah, it was his way or the highway. Go ahead.
Was his dad like that with him?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so it creates a cycle. Go ahead.
No. And when you were younger, how did you deal with it?
In our house, you never talked about it. It was
absorbed.
Yeah, absorbed it. And you know what? And link back to your comment is to Jerry's comment is that. Lloyd. Back to Lloyd's comment is it generational? But what's interesting is that the part of that, if you were to slice and dice it, the domestic violence portion of it, is still very prevalent today in our communities. You know.
Yeah. Well, when I say generational, yeah, I mean the culture continues from generation to generation doing that unless there's some type of dramatic intervention.
Well, there's either something either traumatic or very dramatic is going to have to take place. And, you know, and what's interesting is that even today, it's the issue of anger, fear, and domestic violence, people don't want to talk about because it's, you know, on the outside, like on Facebook or Twitter or anything else, we all look perfect. Life is great, you know. And however, behind the scenes, behind the curtain, there's always it's like a volcano. It's like the cauldron of stuff that's taking place, but nobody ever sees it.
A lot of times people have insecurities and mm-hmm. their own baggage from their childhood, and it's masked as mm-hmm. anger, but it's really a lot of other issues, and it becomes the family secret, not something you talk about inside the family.
Until it blows up.
Yeah, and everybody knows
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Everybody in the family knows it, and everybody the family has regular contact with, they know it, but they become enablers, and nobody talks about it.
Well, it's not, and some people, well, nowadays it's getting to the point where there are programs and places out there. People, and I'll tell you something else, too, is women are just getting plain damn fed up with it now. So now they're calling men out on it because there's so many programs and so many sites and programs and organizations in place. I can name dozens, you know, pull out dozens just here within probably 10 miles of this location in Sandy Springs that are there to support, help and the women, and it will be in their favor. So they're rising up and doing something about it now rather than sitting back and playing second fiddle to a guy either due to insecurity or because of finances, or because they're afraid of speaking out, or because they're afraid of the community knowing what the real truth is. And so it can be a generational. Yes, I do agree with you. It can be very generational. But what I also know is that all of us, everybody on the face of this earth, has got four wonderful, wonderful gifts. That's the gift of self-awareness, conscience, imagination, and independent will. So with my dad, his conscience as a human being, his part of his humanity, I'm very sure just from the look in his eyes, some of his comments he made is that he got it. He just didn't know what the hell to do with it. And so he has a conscience, and he also has the gift of self-awareness. We all have that gift of self-awareness, and we all know that if we step out of ourselves or we're committing an act or doing an act, we know that there's a better way of doing it, or how do I go get help? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you think that anger is left behind sometimes? Because, you know, I mean, if you're a jerk at 40 mm-hmm. and you're a jerk at 80, when you're 40 and you're a jerk, everybody says you're a jerk. When you're 80, they go, he's just old. But for family members, you're just an old jerk.
Well, it's that's good. That's a great way to look at it. But it's another thing, too, is if you we're on, this is live streaming radio. So, but if you're an asshole, you know you're an asshole. Excuse me. And sometimes you can be at such a degree that you don't know you don't know how to go back the other direction. Every one of us knows when we're stepping into that lane of anger and fear and when we're hurting other people. We all have that sense of self-awareness. I've looked at some of them. When I was a former police officer and I was a military commander and as you know, and I have seen people who their only intent in the world was to hurt or kill me. But when you get them one-on-one, when they're out of that realm, they get what they're doing and they know. They just don't know what the hell to do with it and how to ask for help. I can name organizations in this community. John Barrows, who we had on the show a while back, A Better Way Ministries. he was one of those guys at one point, and he many years ago said, "You know what? This just ain't working for me anymore," and started one of the best ministries that this community has seen, and for men, and so, and all of them have seen that and recognized that. But the cool part in the Trump is when you have a good friend or somebody close to you, somebody you love and care about, and they look at you and they go, "Jack, you got a problem." And if you have trust with that person, you have trust with that person, you have integrity with that person, and you're close to that person, you can tell the person, "Hey, look, what you're doing is hurting yourself, and not only that, but it's hurting the people around you." And as also Lee knows, I do professional coaching with executives, CEOs, presidents of companies in the C-suite. And one of the things that I discuss with them is how their anger looks and what causes them frustration. What is it that happens to them? And it's interesting because when I do the assessment and talk with them, there are things that rise up out of that. And they can be very angry people. "Well, they should have done it this way. That's the way I would have done it. Why aren't they doing things this way?" And people can pick that up. You can see an angry person sitting in a room. You have 20 people walk into a room and everybody's getting along very, very well. But you bring in that one victimized, angered person and it'll change the whole dynamic of the team or the organization because people pick up on that and they feed on that. The sad part is when they don't want to do anything about it or nobody calls them on it. And right. So and I get paid to call them on it.
I think that happens a lot of times. Yeah. A lot of it's a boundary issues. Nobody calls them on the boundaries or hold them within the boundaries.
Well, it's also fear, too. My job is attached to my relationship with my boss. My job, my security, who I am, my role in life is attached to my position and my job. So I'm not going to say anything. My security in my life and my money is attached to my relationship with my husband. My security, my relationship, my security, my money, and my role in life is attached to my relationship with my wife. I'm really not going to say anything to her. So we live a life of quiet desperation until the next thing comes along. But all in the meantime, we're sitting there behind the scenes talking ill of those people who are supposed to be the most important people in our lives instead of having that win-win conversation, instead of having that fierce conversation, or instead of setting some time aside and saying, "Hey, look, this is how I see things. Am I wrong? If I'm wrong, please let me know. But here's maybe there's a better way we can do this together rather than
now,
being
adversarial." Is it possible to move a person who is that bully, is that angry person, to a person that is less of a bully or not a bully anymore?
I believe so, especially when they see what the impact is on the people that are most important to them in their life.
Well, yeah. I think if I can comment on it, I think the other issue, too, is maybe as important or more important than moving the person is you have to be moved. You have to look in the mirror and see a good and worthwhile person. You have to see someone who's normal. You have to appreciate that you have a right to your feelings.
Yeah, but
your feelings aren't right or
wrong. If it's your father that's the bully, I mean, you can appreciate it all you want, but guess what? He's going to be there tomorrow and the next day.
And the next day for the rest of your life.
Well, that's yeah. True, but part of that, the bullying part, comes because everybody enables that to happen. But at some point as you're growing up, you know, I told one of my sons a while back, your parents treat you as a child because in their mind you're the child. And when they start treating you like an adult is when you start acting like an adult. When you interact with them on an adult level than a child level, then the relationship can shift. I agree with you. I'm just saying it's not always the role of moving the person as much as it is becoming the person that they don't feel like they can do that with.
Well, that's a double-edged sword with your comment, because you may look at your sons based upon your paradigm, your view of the world, right, and the way you see things, but that is your son. That's not you. That is your son. He's going by a different set of standards, a different set of prescriptions, a different set of social norms that aren't applicable to you and I from years ago. So when you take yourself out of your paradigm, out of your view, and put yourself in his position and go, that's an interesting way of looking at it. I haven't looked at it from that perspective. What would it look like in your son's perspective if the dad always told him, "You can't, you won't, you should, you're under my roof," you know? And then what happens, what may happen is you're going to build up resistance. And what I've seen with very healthy surface, you know, very healthy families is that the child will tell me more than they'll ever tell you or anybody else because they don't have that interaction,
right?
You know, and I've seen, but I also, on the same hand, have seen many fathers and sons, mothers and daughters, and fathers and daughters as well, have very healthy, interactive relationships with each other because it's not adversarial. They create a culture where this child can come and talk to the father or talk to the son or talk to the daughter because they create that, and they're willing to look at the child's perspective. That doesn't mean you always give in to the child.
Hopefully your kids grow up to understand that they have a right to their feelings. Them viewing something differently or seeing life different than you do doesn't mean that you don't love them. You may not necessarily agree with something they say or do, or they don't agree with something you say or do. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that you don't love them or they're less of a person. You just have to grow the relationship to the point where you each have a right to your view.
That's very, very true, and that's very fair. And where I go with the individual is going from a center of self, a place of self. That's the first place, especially with dealing with adult males, adult women and men, is I ask them a very basic question. I said, who are you? And 9 times out of 10, they want to answer with a role. You know,
I'm the VP.
I'm the VP of a company. I'm the dad. I'm this. I said, no, that's a role. That's a title. I want to know who you are. Who are you? And that's when people start. I've had people cry over that question. I've had people get up and want to walk away, and then I'll let them leave, and then they'll come back and ask it, and they'll come back and sit down because they really, really want to know. It's just difficult to answer that question. And so when they ask them that, we eventually get to a place where they have their own personal vision in life, their own purpose in life. And I even get to the point where we develop a mission statement for the individual. It's not mine. It's not yours. It's that person, how they view and see themselves. We come from a place of character, come from a place of integrity, and we come from a place of passion. And when a person finds that in our life, they're unstoppable. They're unstoppable individuals, especially if you teach that to a teen or a kid at a very early age. If you teach that to a teen or a young kid, an adolescent kid, you will change a whole generation if you teach them that. And that is to understand their purpose, their vision, and their talents that they have and how they can contribute to our society. It's a remarkable and it's amazing. I've had grown men who I've worked with as a consultant to that have never had to do that. You know, companies, organizations, Radio X, McDonald's, Chick-fil-A, great companies like that all have mission statements and a purpose. So why don't we have it for ourselves? Going back to my father, and I also talk about it in the book, and going back to my dad, I do believe that at some point, if my dad had that conversation or was in that position and he was at a safe place to talk to somebody about it, it may have been different. But what I did know, and I did realize, the older my father got, the softer he got. Mm-hmm. And because when he realized his own mortality, that there may not be a tomorrow, he started looking at things differently. The quiet conversations he had with me were things like, Jack, make sure you take care of your mother. I said, Dad, I promise I will. Jack, make sure she's got plenty of money. I said, Dad, I promise I will for my mother. And so that part never came out of him back then, but as he got older. So if you and I know that and we have that insight, why don't we teach that to kids, young boys and girls at an early age, that it's okay to know who you are. It's okay to have a vision, have a purpose, and have a mission statement in your life. It's okay to communicate with people, and it's okay to go for the win-win, and it's okay to say no, and it's okay to walk away.
Right. When you have that kind of perspective and that legacy in mind, I think it makes you more vulnerable, because now, at one point, he thought he had all the answers and he could fix everything. At some point, he had the realization that, look, I'm going to need your help on this, so I can't be a jerk and expect your help. So I'm going to have to soften up a little bit if I want to get the outcome I desire.
Going to have to do something. Another thing, too, as I mentioned in the book is that my dad made a couple of comments to me during those moments. And one of the things he said to me is, never, ever let things go that you can fix today. And so I looked at him and I said, this is coming out of my dad's mouth. I said, you got to be kidding me. And then if you look at him in the big picture and what was happening, he got it. That's when I realized he got it. He just didn't know how. He didn't know how to say it.
Right.
And there was nothing he could do to change it.
He said, never let, you know, put off things that you can fix right now because, you know, and I wonder if it was because of a relationship with my mother or it was because of something he did years ago. I don't know. And the other thing he said to me before he passed away was, which was very enlightening to me, was never, ever lie to yourself. And I went, okay, Dad, I got that, you know. And this is the last conversation he ever had with me. And so if I went through the 18, 17 years of living with my mom and dad to get to that point and to learn that from my dad and be able to teach that and speak that to other people, okay, I get it. You know, I get that.
Now, how do you take this book that seems very personal and it's very it's not a business book necessarily, but it has components that are very helpful to people in business. How do you kind of connect it to business and connect it to your work as a business coach?
Great. That's a great question. It's understanding the anger that you have. Anger comes from fear. What are you fearful about? Why are you so upset and so angry? Usually it's because of self-abandonment. A person will abandon themselves. Oh, they'll be victimized. Something may have happened to that person someplace else, and then what happens, they don't know how to handle it, and they'll deal with it, and they will take it into the workplace. Now, I work with C-suite people, I work with bosses, and when I explain that to them, we start doing a deep dive, and they get that, and they realize the impact that it has on their bottom line of their company, mm-hmm. how they show up. Do they come from a place of constant conflict? Do they come from a place or a paradigm where they view all their employees as being lazy? Do they come from a place where they view all their employees as not as people that can't do 100%? And so if he believes that and sees that because he sees himself as a fearful, angry person, he's going to project that. So why am I going to work here? So I'll just do enough because I know you're going to bail me out. You're going to go ahead and take care. You're going to tell me what to do. So what the heck? Why do I want? Right. Why do I care? So when an employee, a boss or an executive understands himself, S-E-L-F, understands himself and how he shows up in the world, he comes from a place of confidence. He comes from a place where his ego is not carried on his sleeve. He comes from a place where he has vision and direction and always goes for the win-win. How can we as a team, interpersonal relationships, work together to help the bottom line and help our company to be very, very successful? And it works. It definitely does work. In addition to that, also, I did a speech recently on the courthouse steps of Coweta County on domestic violence because the anger, the fear, and also part of the domestic violence that took place in our family as well. And so I've been getting a lot of feedback from that, and it's been very, 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 very successful. So on the C-suite side with bosses, it's having a personal mission statement, how you choose to show up, how you choose to view and see yourself, and how you choose to interact with people at work every day. You know, are you a boss where people, as soon as they meet you, 20 minutes later, they're already updating their resume for the next position, you
right,
know?
Because people don't quit jobs, they quit bosses.
They quit the boss, exactly right. You know, are you approachable? Do you bite people's heads off? Are you somebody that they can come to and say, hey, I've got a problem. I made a mistake. Are you the person that's going to cut their head off? Or are you going to say, okay, well, you made a mistake. If you keep making a mistake over and over again, well, we got a problem. But okay, well, how can we fix this? How can we work as a team? How can we collaborate as a team and move forward and fix this as well?
Now, mm-hmm. when you're working with a company, and do they ever come in and say, fix Bill?
Well, first of all, I'd like to talk. First of all, I'd ask, does Bill know you're talking to me?
Right.
Yeah.
In that environment, would that be even possible? Can you fix a person who doesn't think that it's really a problem?
I don't fix the person. I will give the person tools.
Right.
And then it's going to be their choice. And then I also, with that said, it's a great question, great comment, is how do you want to be held accountable and accountability? And some bosses, some people, they want accountability. It's like, okay, here are five things that you're going to do this week. And one of them is, and for men, here, some of the clients I've had, I said, when's the last time you told your wife you loved her and appreciated her? Well, I said, how about if you went home today, on the way home, you grabbed a card and said, just a thank you card, and put it someplace where it's not obvious, but someplace she's going to find it. And just let her know you appreciate her. Okay. You know, and that's foreign. And that builds up their their credibility, their bank account with their spouse. And then what things can you do this week to take care of yourself physically? And they go, well, you know, I really want to lose about 20 pounds. Okay, what's the first step you're going to do to lose your 20 pounds? How are you doing in relationships? Is there somebody you need to tell you love them? Tell somebody you need to make a phone call to? Somebody that you haven't talked to in a while that you want to tell? Well, I haven't done. I say, why haven't you done that? Why can't you do that? It's difficult for us at times to do those things. And so, but when they start realizing that they can do it without worrying about looking different or being weird, strange, or unusual, because our ego or our pride will get in the way, it changes the whole dynamic of the person. They realize, damn, I can do this. I can change my role, change my view. Who taught me that I was less than this? Who taught me that I couldn't do that? So I hit the person from the physical side, relationship side. I talk to them about how mental health, how are they doing? Is there any depression, any sadness? What's going on? Because that stuff behind them is going to be affecting them and their interactions with other people as well. And I've got a great team of people that work with me that I can do referrals to. And I have also have mental health professionals that they take care of it's healthy people helping healthy people. And they'll refer clients to me, and then we set a goal, which are passion, purpose, and vision in life, and said, hey, let's rock it, man. Let's start moving down that aisle. And I give a guarantee, and if 30 days, they don't see a difference. I've never, ever in the last 5 years had to give any money back, you know, so it's a pretty aggressive program. So there was something deep inside me that said, I got to write the book. I got to write about anger, what it looks like, how it manifests itself in my life, how I dealt with my own personal anger, because from my dad, as Lloyd would mention earlier, you know, it'd be generational. And I saw that at an early age, at 14 or 15 years of age, that I chose not to be, I did not want to be that person. And that was quite a revelation for a teenage boy to have that. And so I chose not to. And I said, I'm going to spread the word. I'm going to write a book about it. And I'm going to help other men and then women and kids and teens go through who have gone through this and find a different path and different passion.
Now, if somebody went to learn more, website?
www.sourcepointcoaching.com. And I can be found at Twitter as @sourcecoach. And also I can be found on Facebook at Jack Perry, Source Point Coaching. And the name of the book is The Other Side of Anger, A Son's Search for Peace, and it's on Amazon.com.
Good stuff, Jack. Well, thank you so much for being part of the show.
Appreciate that. Thank you very much.
All right. Next up, Mr. Lloyd Lofton, you chimed in a little early. What was that about? It must have touched you.
First of all, I recognize I'm not your favorite. I got him on that.
I'll admit it. Now you know why.
Now I understand why, yeah. Well, I think it's an issue that everybody deals with. I agree with healthy helping healthy, although it's kind of like saying common sense. If common sense was common, more people would have it.
Sure.
I'm not sure what healthy looks like. I've never met anybody, I think, that's like really healthy. My view is if everybody would think the way I think they should think and behave the way I think they should behave, I'd be a pretty happy person.
That's right.
That's right, yeah.
It's not called healthy, it's called Lloyd.
Yeah, nobody's going
to
do that.
Yeah, and one of the questions I asked people said, what would it look like if everybody came to work every day and looked just like you? Yeah, acted like you, looked like you, and dressed like you, what would it look like? And they go, the sarcastic, angry guy would go, it'd be perfect world. But when you get to their heart, they go, man, that would really suck. That'd be a boring world.
Well, it's like when managers complain about their sales team all the time. I always tell managers, you know, we tend to hire in our own image.
There you go. Good one. I like that.
So the people you're complaining about are really just a mirror of who you hire.
Another facet of you, right?
Yeah, you hire somebody that you feel like you relate with, and then all of a sudden you think they're all a bunch of jerks. Well, you might look in the mirror.
So why don't we talk about training? You got a new training endeavor right now?
Well, you know, the last time I was on your show, we talked about how we had migrated into working with small business owners and doing business loans and credit card processing. And we started coupling training with that. And we got so much requests for training that we started a separate training division. Mm-hmm. We call it Risk Inc., Raising Insight, Skills, and Knowledge. Because the truth is, if people don't have insight into recognizing that there's a problem or something needs to change, they're probably not going to change.
So the people didn't just want a solution. They wanted actually more training to implement the solution to get the best outcome they desire?
That's where we've kind of migrated to, because we've gotten so much requests from that, whether it's retail stores or whether it's call centers or field sales. We've just gotten so much requests for training, and the training's relative to the things they want to accomplish, that we started a separate company to grow that, and that's done very well.
So can you do the training without the other stuff?
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, the training really comes before everything else. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you break down the process of people making a purchase, I'll just kind of walk through the steps. The product, like your book, for example, what is the product to the consumer? Well, it's a solution. What does a solution do? It solves a problem. And how do you know what problem people want to solve? Well, you have to learn to ask questions. And how do you get to ask questions? Well, you have to actually have a prospect. Right, you can be the greatest coach in the world, but if you don't have anybody to coach, what good is it doing? Mm-hmm. So most organizations, when they hire people, they spend 80% of the time training them on the product. The problem is, if a sales presentation takes an hour, how long does it take you to actually tell somebody about the features of your product, no matter what the product is? Say it's the microphone here. How long does it take to tell the features of that microphone? Maybe right. 5 or 10 minutes.
Right.
So most organizations spend 80% of their time training the salesperson on 10% of the sale. So if a sales presentation takes an hour and it only takes you 10 minutes to tell the features of the product, then you're spending 80% of your time to train people on 10% of the sale. So when we started walking people backwards and looking at sales and purchasing in the context of training people to do things and to help consumers buy the things that matter most and to buy things in the order they use those things, then we started finding an uptick in business. And so as people started making more money as a result of the training, they started purchasing more product. So it's kind of like the chicken and the egg. I personally think that the culture of an environment and the sales training and the way you bring people on probably has as big effect on the end result that they're going to get and the increase in business you're going to get as the training that you do it. So
now, does the training work best in a retail environment, or can it work in a B2B or a services or consulting?
Well, sales training is a skill set. It doesn't really matter where you're doing it at. So I've worked with call centers with 120 people in the call center. I've worked at retail shops like Amoco and Mr. Transmission and Pet Land. And we've done web training online with people, with 1,000 people on the call. So the training principles are relative no matter what industry it is or what format it is.
Now, can you teach anybody to be a salesperson? Or is that something you're born with, those skills?
I think you can teach anybody. You know, here's the thing. Most managers, most organizations, in my experience, they tend to recruit people based and hire people based on their perception of that person's ability. And the reason they think that person has ability is because they think that person will get them results. But here's the problem. When they hire the person, if that person's not willing to do the activity necessary to make sales, then they've just got a 90-day wonder. So I don't know that you can train people to be a salesperson. I think you can train people to be better at relationships, and as a result of those relationships, you can teach them the skill set. If I'm going to hire somebody, I'm going to look for somebody that's got the willingness to do the activity necessary to succeed in the business I'm in. I can train the skill sets, but if they're not willing to do the work, the skill sets really don't make any difference.
Now, how do you find out if they're willing to do the work without hiring them?
Well, you know, recruiting actually starts with the very first contact with people. So if I'm working with a sales organization that has a field force, for example,
right,
when they take the recruiting call, one of the things we're going to teach them to do is give assignments on the call. So I might tell you we're going to have our briefing at 9 o'clock, bring a, you know, resume and be on time and come dressed in business attire. And if you show up 10 minutes late and you don't bring a resume and you don't fill out the one-page form we give you and you wear Dockers, then here's what I know for a fact. When I hire you, you're going to be 10 minutes late for every meeting. You're never going to complete the paperwork on time, and you're not going to dress the way we want our company represented. So the attitude and the culture of the organization begins with the very first contact, and that has to carry throughout the person's career with the company. And that, as you mentioned earlier, that starts at the top. So it really doesn't do me any good to train salespeople or midline managers if the leadership of the company doesn't actually think that there's a problem or think something needs to change. You know, the old saying, I've seen the enemy and the enemy is us. Mm-hmm, and that is usually true.
Mm-hmm. Is there a way, though, to tell if a person, you know, say the guy shows up on time, did everything you asked. How do you know that he, though, is going to really perform? You know, if you're asking him to do some task like make 1 million phone calls, you know, make 10 phone calls a day, something that can be tedious and it takes a level of persistence and self-discipline. Do you do assessments or is this, or you just throw them out there and see if they perform or don't perform?
Well, I think that Dale Carnegie wrote a book in 1934 that kind of put to rest the just throw them out there and see who performs. I don't think that works very well. I do think that once you make the decision, once you make a commitment to hire somebody, that you have a moral responsibility to provide them with all the tools and resources necessary for them to succeed. And then it is up to them. So if I were to hire you, if you came through my recruiting process and you met all the criteria, then I'd start giving you assignments right away. Like some of the things I might do is that if it's a contract that consumers have to fill out, I might have you go to the website, print the contract out, complete the contract, bring the contract in for training. And if 10 people show up for my training and you don't have the contract filled out, I probably won't train you. Because what you just told me is that learning how to fill the contract out is not important to you.
Right.
The problem is managers tend to take an emotional investment. They tend to view hires as a reflection of them rather than what their process is. Managers need to be invested in what works. They don't need to be invested in the relationship with the person. I'm not saying the relationships with your sales team isn't important, but the relationship should be based on accomplishment, not on your need to be approved or your need to be liked or your need to be a friend to somebody. So, you know, I'm pretty hard with that. If I do a recruiting meeting with a sales organization and the recruiting starts at 9 o'clock, then I don't let anybody in after 9 o'clock.
So you lock the door?
I would lock the door, absolutely. Because if 10 people are there and one person comes in late, what message does that give the 10 people that showed up on time?
That they can be late next time.
Yeah, well, not in my meeting. But if you let that person in, then the message that you just gave everybody in the room, I mean, it's kind of like having a meeting. I do seminars all over the country. I do about 50 a year. And the truth is, if people come in late, mm-hmm. it really messes up.
The flow.
Yeah, it messes everything up. But the more important than that is the message that everyone gets in the room, that what you said doesn't really mean anything. You're not true to your word.
Yeah, I've got a client that when I go to their organization and I'm contracted to work, start at 9 o'clock. My first slide, it will go at 9 o'clock and I'll start and I'll say, good morning, ladies and gentlemen, this is Jack Perry. And this is, you know, we're going to blah, 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 we're going to do today. And then undoubtedly 10, 20 minutes later, there'll be somebody that comes walking in and it totally takes away the energy and the flow of the room. And then sometimes those people will expect you to stop and catch them up, and I will just keep going until they go to the next break because you got to honor the people that had that were tenacious enough, professional enough to show up on time.
Right.
Yeah. Well, now, you know, I have people that do that, and what I tell them is that's a good question. Come up and see me at the break, and I'll catch up.
Good, yeah.
But I also meet with the event planner or the principal beforehand, and I go over what my requirements are because I want them to be the leader. I mean, they're giving me third-party credibility by introducing me and putting me in front of their people. And I'm going to give that back to them. So mm-hmm. I'm going to tell them what I need from them as a leader, which includes if people come in late, I need you to get up and stop them at the door, and here's what you need to walk them through. So the training that we do and the coaching we do is with sales people that are on the front line. It's with their managers. It's with the upper-level managers. And so we tend to do an assessment that's based on what the mission statement is of the company. Mm-hmm. What's worked and what hasn't worked. But more important than the assessment, at least to me, when I go into an organization, I want to talk to the people that are on the line. I want to talk to the frontline people mm-hmm. because the senior level and the managers are only going to tell me what they want me to know. I started with a combined insurance company back in 1977. I'm an old door-to-door guy. Mm-hmm. And here's what I've learned over the years. Salespeople sell the way they buy. So if I figure a price on something, and in my mind, it's more than I'm willing to pay or more than I can afford. Most salespeople project that onto the customer
right.
and assume that they would feel the mm-hmm, same way. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And managers train the way they sell. So if a manager's way of making appointments, for example, is to use the phone, and I'm an old door-to-door guy, and he says the only way you can succeed here is call and make appointments, I'm going to politely shake my head while I'm nodding approval while I'm in this room. But in my mind, I'm thinking, you're a freaking idiot, and I'm never going to do that. So the people I want to talk to, the ones who really know what's working and not working, I worked with an organization a few years ago, and the CEO of the company said to me, it's a $500 million company, said, we're going to bring in a consulting firm to do some market conduct surveys for us. Do you think that would be useful? So you've got 750 salespeople. You've got 180 every day that write business. Here's what I tell you. Call those 180 and ask them who their competition was in the last 10 days, what the primary product was they sold against, and what the price was, and save the $20,000. Give that $20,000 out as a bonus.
Give it to the employees. Yeah.
So, you know, sometimes what happens is as people get promoted, a lot of times good salespeople, top salespeople, will get promoted into managers because there's an assumption because they can manage themselves, they can manage teams.
Others, right.
And that's just not true. So what happens is the higher you get in a company, the more distance you get from what really works, and then you start listening to the people around you. Well, the problem with a lot of companies is they're compartmentalized. Everybody protects their compartment. Everybody is involved, like you said earlier, Jack, they're involved in their role. They actually think, a lot of companies, not all of them, I don't want to sound like a bad mouth of companies, but a lot of companies think from the inside out. They think about what their process and procedure is, and then they roll that out to consumers of the field. And the truth is you need to figure out why people buy and how salespeople sell and bring that inside the company. I was down in Florida a few weeks ago with my wife and my son for a weekend, and we went through at McDonald's. And when we got done at McDonald's and we paid, they made a comment to me. I told my wife, this is brilliant. I took my phone out and texted it to myself. I thought it was so brilliant. They said, see you tomorrow. Oh, what a great message.
I like that.
What a great message. As you're driving off with your food smelling hot, you got your change, your receipt, you got your drink in your hand, they plant the seed, we're going to see you tomorrow. Mm-hmm. What a great message. If you go to Chili's right here, I live in Conyers. If you go to Chili's, you know what Chili's says to you when the girl sits you at your table?
Right.
What brings you to Chili's today? What a great question.
Yeah.
Right.
What a great question.
Yeah.
Because then they tell the server who comes to the table and say, oh, you're going to the movies
tonight.
Yeah,
the movies tonight.
They love that. It creates bonding, a sense of commonality.
It's a personal connection, too.
Personal connection. They're going to get a higher tip.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the kind of things that matter in business. You know, I worked with a company one time that we were putting signs on the salesperson's door, these magnetic signs.
Yeah.
And someone in legal said, do we really want that? Is that our brand? And I said, let me tell you who your brand is. It's the 5'1", 240-pound guy with a coffee stain that knocks on your customer's door. That's the brand of the customer. All this fancy nonsense you do here and send out isn't your brand. Your people that have interaction with your customer, that's your brand. Now, that was a poor way of putting it to him, but
I had a visual.
But that was the truth.
He might have some anger issues, Lloyd. I have
that did tick me off. It did tick me off. But the good thing is I went home and told my wife, and she corrected me.
So now when you're working with a company, how open to, you know, your ideas are they? Is that something that they're, you know, they have this big problem and they're like, I got to hire Lloyd to solve this? Or is this a nice to have in their business?
Well, I hope they want to hire us to solve the problem. In my experience, most companies don't know what their problem is. What they tell us the problem is when we first meet with them is usually
not
the problem.
Actually the problem.
Yeah. I mean, in my experience, if you look at the opposite of what people say, the truth is somewhere in between. Mm-hmm. So usually what they tell you the problem is isn't what the real problem is. But, you know, I'm being a little more direct speaking with you guys. And, you know, you're more comfortable with Jack because he's very open and creates a safe environment for you. So I'm probably saying more than I should. But when we first meet with companies, we ask a lot of questions. You know, questions gather information and objections disclose information. So I like to ask a lot of questions and get them to disclose what they see as the problem or what they see as not the problem, and then kind of figure out what it is they're actually willing to do. I mean, you can be the greatest coach in the world. You can have the greatest training in the world. There's an old saying in training, and it's an old Zen master saying, it's when does the instructor arrive?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when does a student learn?
When the instructor arrives.
No, when the instructor arrives, the student learns.
Mm-hmm.
So the truth is the instructor doesn't matter unless the student learns something. Does that make sense? So it doesn't matter.
Are they willing?
Yeah, they have to learn something.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's not a matter of what you're teaching or what you're going to do for them. It's a matter of what they're willing to do. So Jack can go in there with some great ideas that he expounded today, but they're only going to do what they're going to do, right?
Right. So that's why we have the accountability. So what is it you want to do? Right. What does success look like? Okay, that's what we're going to work on. Because you try and put 20 pounds of poop in a 5-pound bag, and you got a mess. Work. Yeah, right. You got a mess.
And then you're going to squeeze the bag and wonder why you got crap everywhere.
They're going to call you, fix this.
So now what's the baby step that a company typically starts? What's that first engagement look like for you usually?
Well, I would. The first thing we do is look at what has happened over the last 90 days. We look at what they want to do in the next 90 days.
So you look at 90-day period, not a year, not
correct.
3 years.
That's correct. Yeah, because people can only duplicate what they see you doing today. Uh-huh. Your team can only replicate what they see you doing today. So we look at what they did in the last 90 days, where they want to be in 90 days from now, have them write three things down they think that works, three things that they think doesn't work. And then I want some time to go interview people. I want to go interview the managers, the salespeople. And then I'll come back and say, you know, here's what I see is going on. Here's the three things that I think you should do. Here's the three things you wanted to do. Where do you want to go with this?
How often do you find that it's not necessarily the product or that they're trying to sell or utilize, but it's interpersonal communication. It's communication or trust in the organization. Do you find that often?
Well, I do. I think trust is actually mislabeled and misplaced a lot of times.
Yeah.
I think the higher level the manager is, the more he wants to believe that his process works. And the people that work around him interpret that as not trusting them. Mm-hmm. If you want someone to implement something, to accomplish something for you, it's probably a good idea to listen to the people that are actually going to do it. You may have a bigger vision, but the problem may be you're disclosing that vision. The problem may be that you're not getting that vision out there so they understand it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But in my experience, a lot of times higher level managers tend to micromanage too much. So what they really don't trust is their team. If they trust their team, they're able to delegate, give very clear boundaries of what they want to have accomplished, and then step back and let them accomplish it.
Yeah, that's the difference between a leader and a manager.
Well, managers manage things and leaders lead people.
Yeah.
So, you know, the truth is the way to know if a system works, in my experience, is if the leader leaves, if you go for a week or two and you come back and everything's run well and you've made progress, then your system works. But if the leader has to be there for the system to work, you don't have a system. You have a controlling leader who micromanages everything. So the organizations that I walk into, I like to get the manager out of the office for a day or two. And let's see what happens and then go back in the office and see what's taking place. And that will tell me more about the leadership of that manager. But just even your call board can tell you everything. I mean, if you have a call board on there that says you have to have so many appointments and so many sales at the end of the week, and you've got 10 salespeople and two salespeople haven't sold anything for 3 weeks, I don't care what the other 8 people have done. The nonverbal message to everybody is the call board's a lie. You don't have to have 5 sales a week or 5 sales a month.
Right.
The truth is you can have no sales and still be here.
And so, but also, what if they had that one sale and you worked a lot of your time on that one sale and it trumps all the other 20 calls you're going to make? Is that, you know, does
well, I would say that depends on the business model and depends on what your ticket price is. But
okay.
if you work at a car lot,
yeah,
and you worked on a sale for a long time and another salesperson sold 2 cars while you sold 1, even though you might have made more money on that one call. You know, the problem may, there could be a lot of other problems. The problem may be is you're too much into the relationship with people.
Okay.
Maybe you're trying to win people over because you want to be their friend. Maybe you want to buy from you because you're a friend. Maybe you're not a hard closer. Maybe you're not a good closer. I don't know. I'd have to know the situation.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, the training that you do, is it in person? Is it through the internet? How does it get rolled out?
We do it in person. And we also do webinars.
And then you get the same level of effectiveness in person as webinars?
Depends on what the training is. The actual sales presentation training,
right?
The actual physical act of doing the presentation, you do better if you're live, if you have a group of people together.
Mm-hmm.
Although you can do it on the internet. I would tend to use Skype more than I would use like Brain Shark, although we do a lot of training on Brain Shark or PowerPoints. But the best training is the training that targets what people are willing to do. The best training is, in my opinion, the rifle approach. You pick one topic, one skill set, and you focus on that, and then you have a follow-up, and then you set some kind of reward or accountability to it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if somebody is going through the training, is it something that they go through it for 90 days, or do you contract with them for a long period of time? How does that work?
Well, it depends on what we're training on. So if we're going to train on the seven steps, that would probably be a three-day training. Mm-hmm. And then we would contract with people to do either follow-up coaching individually, or we would do coaching calls with people. If I have my preference, I like to have the manager trust us enough to step out of the way and just let the salespeople call me directly.
Right.
And I have salespeople that will call me right from a customer's business, home, whatever. They'll call me right from there and say, you know, here's the problem I have. And then the biggest questions that you get, the biggest training requests you get is handling objections, asking questions, closing, and doing the sales presentation. And salespeople will call when they feel safe, when the manager has transferred that credibility, and they know they can call you. But they'll call you, and they'll ask you questions about how to solve that. Because I think people inherently want to be good and mm-hmm. successful. I think
right.
salespeople in particular, they want to be successful. No salesperson I know wants to spend 8 or 10 hours out in the field and come home and have your spouse or significant other ask you that question that you just cringe on, which is, did you make a sale today?
Right.
No, I'm a loser, and thanks for asking.
Well, I can't.
No, nobody wants that question.
Can't wait to go out tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, I was in Johnston, Tennessee one time, and I'd left my house in Knoxville at 6 in the morning. I called my wife at 8 o'clock at night. I had a new salesperson, a car I was training, and I said, we're on our way home. She said, did you make a sale? Damn, I hate you. No, I didn't. So I go back in my lead cards. We find somebody, get done at 10. We made a sale.
Now you can go home.
I call her up and say, okay, I made a sale. I'm coming home. She said, well, how much did you make? I said, I'm coming home.
I'm coming home, yeah.
But that's great, though. That's great to have that kind of culture and that type of attitude. But can you asked earlier, it was a great question, can you teach somebody to sell? Yeah, you can teach the sales skill, but I can't teach that. I can't teach the
make one more call.
The inspiration.
Right.
I think there's a difference between inspiration and motivation.
Mm-hmm.
I hate it when people say, if they come to one of my training, they say, I was motivated. I feel like I did a bad job. Because motivation is an emotion, and people's emotions change. They mm-hmm. go from day to day. And the problem is at 8 o'clock at night on a Thursday on a country road, if you haven't made any sales and you've got to pay for your kid's soccer on Friday
yeah.
and you've got to make a car payment, and that feeling of being motivated has left you. Now what do you do?
Right.
That's a good point.
I like inspiration. I like people to be inspired. I call it inspirationally dissatisfied. If I can inspire you to do one thing different, and that's probably what's different about our training as coaches, I'm not trying to change the world or change your business. Let's pick one thing that you will do and you'll commit for your team to do. Let's get them inspired to make that change. And, you know, the truth is most people, even back to your topic on anger, most people, they already know what the problem is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my wife and I operated group homes for abused kids for 14 years. I didn't have to tell some kid what he was doing wrong. He already knew what he was doing wrong.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
We worked with gang kids for years. They already knew what the problem was. You don't have to tell them what the problem
yeah,
is.
Yeah, it's that self-awareness. We've all
yeah,
got it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. People already know that. So I don't have to tell a salesperson what they're doing. I don't have to tell a salesperson are you making 80 phone calls a day? Are you spending 2.5 hours on the phone every day? Because they already know they're not doing that.
Right.
The question is how is what you're doing getting you what you want? That's a better question.
Yeah. Can only fool yourself for so long.
Yeah. I mean, it's reality Socratic yeah. questioning. So I'm not going to. It would depend on the organization. I've got to kind of figure out what the leadership's philosophy is and what they're willing to address and how they're willing to change. Before I can talk about what we think might need to
happen. Have you ever had a situation where you had to go back to the manager or the person who hired you and said, I think you may be part of the problem?
I've probably not like the CEO,
yeah,
but
yeah.
I've sat in a room with a CEO and two senior vice presidents, and I've said to the senior vice president, you guys don't need to hire me. You're the problem.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then I looked at CEO and said, if this doesn't get corrected here, you're going to waste the money you would spend for me coming in here.
Yeah.
Now
yeah.
that really created a problem in the room, but you can't lose something you don't have. And
yeah.
I wanted to, if I didn't get him on board right then,
right,
yeah. I already knew I wasn't going to have anything.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The good thing about him is he already knew that what he was doing wasn't working. Like you said, his ego was standing in the way. The mm-hmm. problem is the CEO wouldn't hold him accountable for it. The CEO was more concerned about what the roles of people were than the effectiveness of people.
Right.
And his team already knew he was a jerk. He didn't want to be a jerk. He didn't know another way of being it. So they ended up hiring me because it was a great opportunity for him to step aside, take my credibility, let
right.
his team like me and make yeah. changes with me, And then I was able to pass that credit back to him, and he was able to start learning to be a little bit different with his team mm-hmm. by using my credibility, and nobody had to say he was the bad guy. I was able to say behind closed door. But I do that. If I meet with salespeople, I've got 40 people in the room, I'm going to meet with the managers first, and I'm going to have an understanding with the managers, because I've walked out of trainings before when managers don't cooperate.
Yeah.
So, you know, they have to not correct their team in front of me. So I don't care what question or comments people make, and people make some pretty rude comments, don't they?
Oh, yes.
Oh.
I mean, really rude comments. But I don't care what questions or comments their team makes. They need to stay out of it and let me handle it. If they can't trust me to handle it, don't hire me to begin with.
Right.
And the second thing is that you have to be the first in and the last out. You know, don't have your tell your team they have to be in the room at 9 o'clock for training, and then you show up at 9:20 and then leave the room four times taking phone calls.
Yeah.
I understand you're the manager or the senior vice president or, you know, whatever. I understand that. But the message you're giving them is either the training's not important or what you're expecting them to do not is not that important.
Yeah,
if it's important enough for the company to spend money on, then either be in the room the whole time or don't come in there. Introduce me, leave, and don't come back.
Right. You got to be all in. This isn't
You're introducing a culture of behavior when you get up and walk out, or I got to take this phone call, I got to check this text message, I got to check this last email that came out. You're creating a culture of non-accountability.
Right. Yeah. And you know what we do is I have a whiteboard in the room, and I create a parking lot. So I'll go around the room and I'll ask each person in the room, tell me how long you've been with the company, what industry you came from before you came to work here, and what's the one thing you want to get out of the class. And I'll do that with every 40 or fewer people. I'll do that with everybody in the room. And then the first lesson everyone learns is that everyone has the opportunity to be successful. Because if there's 40 people in the room, there's 30 industries represented.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
they come from everywhere.
Sure.
And then there's usually two or three primary topics that people want to learn. And what I like about the parking lot is at the end of the training, I can go back to each person and say, you want to learn how to handle objections? Tell me one thing you learned that you'll do differently. And then I can take my pen and mark it off, which is kind of like mentally marking the objection off.
Right.
So now they own that. They walk out. They might say that I suck. They might say the training suck.
Mm-hmm.
But they'll walk out and they'll remember the one key phrase they learned for handling objections or whatever it was.
Good stuff. Now, if somebody wanted to learn more, website?
LloydLofton.com, LloydLofton, LloydLofton.com.
Where the training stuff is?
That's correct. Or 865-776-7632. We have 120 training vignettes on there, little two-minute training videos. So everything from handling objections to bookkeeping problems to all kind of industries, doing web banners. We have 100 different training videos on there you can go on and look at.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for being part of the show today.
Appreciate being here. And, Jack, thanks for sharing with me.
Oh, it's awesome. Thank you very much. Thanks
thank you, Jack. Me. All right, this is Lee Cantor. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.